You are listening to the Holistic Travel Nurse Podcast. Thanks for stopping by, checking it out. This episode is taken from Jack Hibbs again and William Fetter. This is about socialism. This is about understanding what the heck's going on in the world, some of what's going on in the world, and a little bit of history lesson. So it makes you think, what should you be doing? And I hope you kind of get that. I think that our nation in the U.S. and Australia, friends from around the world, need to stand up and fight against their governments that are taking over your power, unless you want to be like China, where you have absolutely no voice. And I don't want that. So I hope that this inspires you. I hope that you enjoy it. Go check out the whole episode. I'll send you the show notes. It's always in the show notes. Thanks.
How was dinner? Listen, second night in a row for Mediterranean, Middle Eastern food. It's what we do. Yes. I have not had the time to watch Mike Lindell. I will go back and review it. I understand that they have been receiving incredible. You guys, what? You're remarkable. To prove how incredibly accurate and viable the data is by these global experts. Mike Lindell was physically attacked yesterday. And the presenters, these are global experts on what happened on election night. Their homes, it's like it's not even subtle. Their homes this week were raided by the FBI. And one of the guys is a diplomat from Brazil. We're not in Kansas anymore, ladies and gentlemen. We're not even in America anymore. Question, yeah. Yes, the huge question that's, I'm stalling right now. The green movement in the church, it's gonna grow. It's biblical, green movement moving into the church. Romans chapter 1 says that in the last days, there will be a movement to worship creation over rather than the creator. So that's gonna escalate more and more. You're gonna see more and more churches. The next move for a woke church is gonna be a church that hugs trees. I mean it. It's going to be a church that worships nature. And in Europe, it's already happening on a huge scale. And the belief system is that they are going to usher in a utopia. That has always been a demonic plot, that man could create a utopia. Bill wonderfully debunked that last night. If you missed last night, my opinion was one of the greatest messages, not only delivered in this church, but it was one of the greatest messages I have ever heard in my life. And I wound up announcing to the staff today, because you know many of them were serving, so they missed it. So I said, which is very rare here in this church for me to say this, but I told the staff, it is actually mandatory required viewing. You must see this, because you will never understand socialism as clear as... Wow, we need to put them in the high school. Sure we do. The problem is we've allowed crazies to control. And so, but hopefully, Lord willing.
Are you concerned with the voting process coming up for the Gavin Newsom?
Yeah, of course, the voting process regarding Gavin Newsom. Thank you for asking that. Ladies and gentlemen, please hear this. I sadly did a video today that I think I recorded it and I'm like upside down. But I'm not going to take it off because the content is important. And part of this voter integrity thing, here's what has to happen. There has to be an overwhelming turnout to flood the perpetrators of the fraud. Fraud is already happening because as the governor has downloadable PDF ballots that you can, there's nothing that prevents you from voting 6, 7, 8, 10 times. I'm praying to the God of heaven that people who vote like that wind up voting wrong and wind up voting the right way without knowing about it. What you must do is you must do the right thing regardless. You have to understand that as believers, if 10,000 people are doing the wrong thing and the moment comes for somebody to do the right thing, you have to be that one person to do the right thing. Because it has nothing to do with numbers. It has everything to do with what is right before God. So what we must do, you're going to see on your ballot which will come out Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. You're going to receive it. You're going to hear an announcement on Sunday, by the way, about what to do with your ballot because we want to protect your vote. We will make sure that your vote not only gets counted but gets to the right place to be counted correctly without manipulation. We did it last time in November of 2020, and it was remarkable. In fact, we've been asked by other places. We were being asked by Virginia if we will come and show communities how to do what we did here. It went that well. So having said that, we're committed to voter integrity. Unfortunately, not everybody is. You're gonna have one ballot. You're gonna have two votes. In fact, I just got on the phone. If you don't know Senator Grove, I was just on the phone tonight, just prior to coming out here with Senator Grove, and she was laying it out. One ballot, first question, as she was looking at it, it says right there, should Gavin Newsom be removed from office? Okay, it's gonna ask you, it's that simple. Well, listen, you answer that question, you answer it, the answer is yes. Let me pray about it, the answer is yes. As we mentioned last night, when you signed the petition a couple months ago, you didn't vote. You signed the petition to make the vote happen. Congratulations, you did it. Now the vote's happening. You must vote. You can't set it out. You vote. Yes, he must be removed from office. Next question. Watch this. Next question is, who do you want to replace him? You're going to have a list of names, okay? Whoever gets the most wins. Watch this. It's not delegates. It's not electoral college. It's just like this. The question for number one is 50% plus one. For Gavin Newsom to be impeached or recalled, there has to be 50% plus one. Concerning the second question, let's say John Cox gets 10,000 votes and Larry Elder gets 10,001 vote. Larry Elder wins. Whoever gets the most votes wins on that night, in that moment, assuming there's no fraud. We're going to be asking you, if you're up to this, when you vote, some people will vote in person, some people will bring their votes here. You should try your best to document yourself on your own device. Hi, my name is Jack. I just voted for Larry Elder and I cast my vote and I voted to remove Gavin Newsom. I just did that. Why do that? Because if the result is at the end of this election that 93% of Californians voted to keep Gavin Newsom in office, then there could be thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of us that say, wait a minute, I'd like you to watch this video. This is what we've been reduced down to. I've told you this before, and then I'll introduce Bill this evening. We're very excited to see what's going on with young people across America. Huge numbers of young people are joining the fight to defend our nation, and it's fantastic, beautiful. Turning Point USA is doing a world-class job. And you know, Charlie Kirk is, you can't take the wind out of Charlie Kirk very easily. But I was able to, unfortunately, succeed in doing that when he had made a comment about something. And I said, Charlie, I don't know, man. I said, you're talking like what you just said is, well, the Constitution says this. And I said, Charlie, man, I got to tell you, I haven't seen evidence of a U.S. Constitution as I review it. I haven't seen the evidence of the Constitution being upheld, universally upheld, from top to bottom. I think it died somewhere in the middle term of Barack Obama. And he stopped. And I said, listen, Supreme Court, look how they're acting. They're not obeying the Constitution. Look how Congress, they're not obeying the Constitution. Look at what's happened. This, not obeying the Constitution, down and down and down the list they went. It's very possible. When you have the FBI spying on Americans, as they are now, then you have a weaponized IRS, you have a weaponized ATF. That's at the bidding of whoever the dictator is. And I personally do not believe that we have constitutional rights any longer. I think we're living off the fumes. And I have a lot of evidence to back that up. People don't want to hear that. But we live in an interesting time.
Jack, can I ask one last question?
Last question. I can tell you, great question. Larry Elder, he's asking, other candidates are debating, but Larry Elder is not in the debates, and I don't think he's going to be in any debates for this reason. There's no reason for him to go into a debate. What Larry Elder is doing is causing his numbers to rise. Why would you engage in a debate? To win. Larry's winning without debates. This is something unique. There's nobody close to him in the numbers. He's in the polling. And his social media and his personal appearances are just causing the trajectory to go. So I know for a fact that his campaign team have told him, you don't have a need. There's no need to do that. You are rising. And the financial support is pouring in. And so I asked Senator Grove today, I said, what is your gut on this? And she's sharp, and she ran through some numbers. And if the election was to happen tonight, assuming Newsom is ousted, right, that Larry wins big if it were tonight. Here's the thing. Oh boy. We need to pray. You guys, the other team, they're always united, almost always united. They know how to unite. The Christian community almost never unites. The Christian community gets in fights over things like this. Trump, no Trump. Hillary, no Hillary. You just pick the topic. And the Christian community, it's almost like the Christian community was born with something missing when it comes to being able to wage a warfare in this world. Didn't Jesus say that the children of this world are more savvy, more shrewd than the children of the kingdom? That was an insult. I hope you got that. Jesus said that. Jesus said, the kids of this world, they know how to fight. My kids, not so sharp. And we need to be careful because a Christian will get in, for example, in this election, there's some good Christian people running, but nobody knows who they are. Nobody knows, you might know who they are, but the state doesn't know who they are. And some of them won't even make it on the ballot, I think. They didn't even get the numbers. So then what do you do? Oh no, I can't vote. Well, remember what I'll always be saying this. If this person is pro-life and this person is not pro-life, then I already know how to vote according to my Bible. Yeah, but that guy's not my flavor. What is that? See, this is where Christians go off the track. We lose it. We don't have the skin to understand. Jesus said it this way, don't go to war unless you first have figured out that you've got the ability and the means to win it. But we never think like that. We have to be careful. We have to be wise. So unfortunately at this time, the Christian community doesn't believe that the candidates are Christian enough. So what's going to happen, what could happen, is that Newsom stays in. If Newsom stays in, I have to tell you personally, if Newsom stays in, I have to relocate out of this state. He knows my name. I'd have to get out of California. So you're not, because I'm not going to tell you where I'm going. You guys, he needs no introduction, especially if you were here last night. I'm actually blessed that tonight we don't have worship time. We're going to go straight into class time. And William Federer is a prolific author. His books will be available. Some of them will be available in the foyer after service. I promise you. If you buy any of his books and you're not blown away, I'll give you your money back. Because everything he's written, I think, I own. And he is so reliable, so dependable. And why he is revered as he is, and I can say this, he won't say this. Those who disagree with him fear him because what he footnotes and what he puts out there is not his feelings. You can look at it. And you got a taste of that last night. So, without further ado, he's back. He's had a very busy day filming and doing television stuff, but we're happy to have him here on the West Coast. Give a warm welcome to Bill Federer.
Thank you, Pastor. Amen. Hallelujah. Thank you, Pastor Jack Hibb. Thank you, Lisa. Well, I thought I'd pick up with where I left off last night. Is that okay?
Yes.
And I have a chapter in my book on socialism on how to brainwash a nation. So let's just jump in. In the 1800s, marketing was Wells Fargo Wagon and Sears Catalog. And they would list every single feature about an item that they're selling, like a sewing machine. And then the early 1900s came along and they began to sell things through magazines and not let people know about the product. And the classic is Crisco. Nobody knew what was in Crisco. And yet they had these slick magazine advertisements of happy families with really nice looking food, and it made it look like everybody's using it. And they even made up a term, vegetable based. Nobody knew what vegetable-based was, but yet it was so effective, it put out of business the lard industry, right? They used to render fat from animals that then used it to make soap and so forth. And so, do you know what's in Crisco? Cottonseed oil. So in the South, they would grow cotton, and then they would have these seeds that they wouldn't use, and they just pile them up, mountains of these things. And somebody had the, they would smash them into this black, mucky oil that they would use in machinery in factories. Nobody ate that stuff. And somebody had the idea of boiling it and bleaching it and putting it in cans and selling it with a nice ad campaign. And we've all eaten it. And but it was a phenomenon. Instead of people knowing everything about a sewing machine, they know nothing about it, but it looks like everybody's using it. And so there was the popular cartoon in a New York newspaper called Keeping Up with the Joneses. And it's this idea that you're buying things because you see other people with things, not because you've done your homework. And then we see how to influence and brainwash a nation, sensationalism through publications, magazines, newspapers, and the classic is the Spanish-American War. And so the country was pretty isolationist. We were busy with our own lives, but there was injustice going on in Cuba. And William Randolph Hearst, New York Journal, and Pulitzer Prize, or Joseph Pulitzer, who does the Pulitzer Prize, he had the New York World. And they began to stir up public sentiment, not to buy a sewing machine or Crisco, but to intervene in Cuba with the foreign policy. And so Hearst famously had his illustrator, Frederick Remington, go to Cuba and document it. And there was the Spanish General Weyler, and he had concentration camps, and hundreds of thousands were being killed. And Frederick Remington, Hearst told Remington, you furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war. Now, it did mobilize the country to get involved and to free Cuba from the oppressive Spanish government. We need to do that again, only this time from a totalitarian government. But it's this idea that the press realized that they had the ability to sway public opinion, not just to buy Crisco, but to change their views on foreign policy. Then we see the radio drama, War of the Worlds, 1938. And Orson Welles is an actor, and it's H.G. Welles's space novel, but he goes on the radio and he says, we interrupt this program to announce that New Jersey is being invaded by Martians. Everybody in the country panics, freaks out, runs outside and looks for spaceships, right? It was a phenomenon that how you could get an entire nation to go into instant panic and fear and hysteria. And so this was studied by Joseph Goebbels. He is the Nazi minister of propaganda. And he realized fear of the war and people changing their behavior if they see everybody else buying a product or whatever. And so he would orchestrate these events with 100,000 people, and they would begin to give the Hitler salute at the front, and it would work its way back. And then everybody would see everybody else giving the Hitler salute, and then you would feel pressure to give it, and then people would see you giving it, and they would feel pressure to give it. And all of the country was suddenly wrapped up in supporting this. I mean, how do you brainwash a nation? Well, he figured out that you have fear, and you make it look like everybody's doing it. So it's actually got a term. It's called fear-mongering, and it's the manipulation of people into hysteria. Now, America begins to do something similar, and we have a Army and Air Force motion picture service. I mean, what are they doing making motion pictures? They just think, oh, we want to do some entertainment. No, they realize that this is a powerful, persuasive means, and they would even set up tables in the lobby of the movie theater to sign up recruits. I actually talked to a guy that joined the military by signing up in the lobby of the movie theater. They would have patriotic movies. Now, it was legitimate in the sense that it was mobilizing the country for a patriotic purpose to defend our country against a genuine threat. But it shows the power that they've been studying on how to manipulate and how to get people to not just to buy a product, but to buy an ideology. This was studied some more with the movie Gaslight. I don't know if you've seen, how many have seen that? Ingrid Bergman, and if you've not, she is a young woman whose aunt was a famous actress in the movie, and the aunt was given some jewels, and she dies. And all of her acting stuff and whatever else is stored in the attic, and Ingrid Bergman inherits the house. It's in London, and anyway, a guy wants the jewels, And so he becomes friends with her and courts her and marries her. And he wants to, you know, the old black and white movies, he like puts her in her bedroom and he says, I'm going to go for a walk and smoke his pipe or whatever. And he goes out of the house down the street. And like in London, all the houses are connected like Mary Poppins, you know. And so he climbs along the roofs and goes in through the attic and turns the gas lamp on in the attic. And when he turns it on in the attic, it gets dimmer in her bedroom. And she tells him, she goes, you know, every time when you go out for a walk, the light gets dimmer in my bedroom. He says, oh, your eyes are playing tricks on you. You're seeing things. You're going crazy. Maybe you're going. And then he would egg her on. He would show her a brand new watch. And then he said, hey, we're going to go out to dinner to this big public event. And everybody's there. And he's showing his watch. And then all of a sudden he says, my watch is gone. And everybody's looking around for it. And then he reaches in her purse in front of everybody and pulls it out and says, oh, you took it. But it's not your fault. You're a kleptomaniac. And you didn't know what you were doing. You're just going. And he was convincing her that she is crazy. And he's about to sign her into an insane asylum. Then he can go in the attic and dig around all he wants for the jewels until the hero of the movie sees the guy go down the street and saw his light go on in the attic and it goes dimmer in the bedroom and he breaks the story and he gets drug away. But it's this concept that went into our vernacular, gaslighting. How you manipulate a person, but now we're taking it to a national level. How do you manipulate the perception for an entire nation? Now, it actually goes back to ancient Greece. And now, the most common form of government in world history is kings, Pharaoh, Caesar, Kaiser, Sultan, Tsar. And if you have an agenda, how do you pitch your agenda to the king, right? So in China, the emperors had 2,000 concubines and they had the Mandarin eunuchs, and you would have to bribe the mandarins to arrange for you to get a meeting with the emperor so you could pitch your agenda. Well, in Athens, they didn't have an emperor or a king. It was the people who were in charge. And if you have an agenda, how do you pitch your agenda to an entire city? That's when they invented theater. They'd get the whole city in a big outdoor amphitheater, and they would put on plays. Comedies, satires, tragedies, where they would ridicule and buffoon some points of view and honor and extol other points of view. And if you've ever read, you know, Greek Aristophanes, who was wrote comedies, I mean, they would ridicule politicians by name. Sort of like, you know, Saturday Night Live, where they'd make somebody act like the politician and make fun of them. And people would leave the theater saying, I don't want to be like that poor guy that was made fun of. And they start backing away from him. And then they portray somebody else or other views as noble and, you know, upright, and people leave the theater and say, oh, I want to be like that. And from that time till now, theater is always political in a country where it's the people who are in charge. I mean, somebody's paying for all that stuff to be on there, and they're pushing, somebody's writing the script, somebody's hiring the people that write the scripts, right? And so you think of your favorite sitcom or movie, and there is a character that you like, you identify with. They're cute, they're funny, they're the hero. And as this series goes on, this character begins to make morally compromising decisions. Little lust, little cheating, little lying, little revenge, and you find yourself apologizing for him, saying, yeah, I know James Bond is with a woman he's not married to, but he's about to save the world. So can we get on with the story? And it minimizes something that used to be really important, right? Marital fidelity. It's sort of, oh, that's not that important. And then they will call people, portray people who hold to old traditional values. Make them look like simpletons and bumpkins and backwards and idiots. And you turn the show off like, man, that guy did look a little bit. He was like too strict and he was too. And the other person, you know, he was cool. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go out and buy the tennis shoes that he wore. I'm going to wear the cologne that this, you know, this actress was. You want to emulate those. And so from that time till now, theater, media is a way to manipulate the public. So if you have an agenda, you want to begin to portray it positively, and then those that you don't like, you begin to portray them negatively, and you're moving the population in your political direction the same way that the Greeks did. So it's sort of a gaslighting type thing. Now, this was studied. We are all familiar with the psychological operations called PSYOPs during World Wars I and II, and after that, where our army would drop pamphlets in the other nation's language. that would say things like, oh, your side is already lost and you're just, your general just hasn't told you yet, but you're really just fighting futile and you just go ahead and give up, and it would mess with their minds. But they did the same thing to us. And so the famous is Tokyo Rose. She had a really sort of seductive voice, and she'd be on the radio in English, and she'd be telling all the Americans, like, oh, you're terrible, and you're, you know, and so forth. So this has been studied, how you manipulate. And so it actually is a Sun Tzu's Art of War, 5th century BC in China. And generals would fight. And Sun Tzu said, the best general is the one who can get his enemy to surrender without even fighting. Yeah. That you psych them out. You make them think that you're more powerful than you are. You make it look like your troops are everywhere. You mess with their minds, psych them out, and then they lose heart and they surrender. And so that's called the Sun Tzu's Art of War. But then there's something else called fifth generation warfare. And that's where you get your enemy to surrender without them even knowing that there was a war. And that's what we're experiencing right now, right? So they get you to surrender, but you don't even know that you're in a war. I mean, that's like the ultimate. And so this wanting to influence this mental psyche, the view of a large population, another step in it is the Cold War. And our country was busy with all of our lives, and the CIA director was Alan Dulles, and he realized that we needed to mobilize our country to fight communism. And so it's called Operation Mockingbird, he had the CIA feed stories to all the top news agencies in America, and to get people, you know, mobilized to the threat against, but he confessed to it. And so it's in Carl Bernstein, who was the famous Watergate Washington Post reporter. He wrote about it in a Rolling Stones interview in 1977, how the CIA is feeding stories to our press. And but we see articles recently of now it's gone online. And so it's not just your major newspapers and major TV. Here's one article: Facebook voter drive swayed election to Biden. Another is big tech's effort to sway the election revealed. Another NPR is in Twitter we trust. Can social media sway voters? So now we have big tech wanting to sway what people think. And so if we do a little connect the dots, in America, the country is controlled by laws. Laws are controlled by politicians. Politicians are controlled by voters. Voters are controlled by public opinion. You can't vote for what you don't know about, and the only thing you know is through, right? And public opinion is controlled by media, education, the church. The church helps form public opinion for those that go to church, and the internet. Now, why is the internet different than media? Because all the other ones now use the internet. It goes through the internet for churches to communicate and education and so forth. And so if someone can control media, education, and infiltrate the church and control the internet, they can control what the public knows. And they can control public opinion, and the public opinion influences the voters, and the voters vote for the politicians, and the politicians make the laws, and the laws control the country. Can you see it? Now, if I can figure it out, they can figure it out, right? It's sort of like in a home, a big sister knows that, you know, maybe the dad is the one that might make the final decision, but she knows if she can nag mommy, then mommy will go nag dad. But if she can tease little brother and get him to cry, then that'll get mom upset, mom will get dad. I mean, you know how little kids are. They can figure things out. One time, I have 11 kids in my family, 5 brothers, 5 sisters, and so I have twin little brothers. And when they were, we lived in a house with wooden floors, and there were 2 cribs, and they were on the other side of the room. And I heard my one little brother crying, and I go in, and my other little brother's crib had been moved all the way across the room. And he is in there sucking a bottle, and at his feet is another bottle, and the other brother's in the other crib with no bottle. And he's like looking like what? He had scooted his crib all the way over, climbed over, took the bottle away from his brother, climbed back into his crib, and he's sucking them up. Little kids can figure that out, right? How to do things. And so here, people have figured out if you can control the internet and the education media and the church, you can control public opinion, which controls the voters, which controls politicians and laws and controls the country. One of the people who is known for this is Antonio Gramsci. And he, at this time, realized that America cannot be defeated on the battlefield. We are invincible on the battlefield. So his idea was to rot us from within. So it's called the Long March Through the Institutions. It's sort of, if you've ever heard of the Seven Mountains of Influence, it's sort of the Seven Mountains of Influence in reverse. It's him saying, we have got to win all of these mountains. It's this long march through the institution and rot every one of them. So Antonio Gramsci, he's an Italian socialist, dies in prison, but he has his notebooks. And in there he says, the civilized world has been thoroughly saturated with Christianity for 2,000 years. Any country grounded in Judeo-Christian values cannot be overthrown until those roots are cut. Now, what's Judeo-Christian values? That basically is the concept of the individual. All other structures are what they call honor, shame, and you want to be part of a group, whether it's Islamic, Muslim male or Hindu, you want to be in the Brahmin caste on the top or whatever. The Judeo-Christian concept of you have a worth and an identity because you are made in the image of God. Whether you can contribute to society or not, you're worth the same. And the God that we worship, there's no respect of persons. Everyone's equal. So those are the Judeo-Christian values. But he says, we got to get rid of those because we want people to identify with the group, and then whoever controls the group is in charge. So he says, socialism is precisely the religion that must overwhelm Christianity. I think it's interesting he calls socialism a religion. He says, in the new order, socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of schools, universities, churches, and media. See, he started listing those mountains, transforming the consciousness of society. So it was this long march of going in them. George Orwell wrote a book in 1948. The title of his book is 1984. He switched the numbers, right, for the book. And in this dark futuristic novel, George Orwell has a character named Winston, and he works at the Ministry of Truth, and his job is to edit history and change it and put all the evidence of the real past history in a pneumatic tube that he sticks in like old banks, you'd stick the thing and it'd suck it up there, and it would suck it down the memory hole and throw it into an incinerator. And he writes this, every record has been destroyed or falsified, every book rewritten, every picture has been repainted, every statue and street building has been renamed, every date has been altered. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. I know, of course, that the past is falsified, but it would never be possible for me to prove it, even when I did the falsification myself. After the thing is done, no evidence remains. The only evidence is inside my own mind, and I don't know that any other human being shares my memories. Everything faded into mist. The past was erased, the erasure was forgotten, and the lie became truth. If there's no God, there is no absolute truth, and you can change history all you want. The same way they spin news articles today, they simply spin history. The classic of this was the Egyptians and the Hittites, which is area of Turkey today, had the famous Battle of Carchemish. And you're familiar with it because this is the battle where the wonderful King Josiah comes out and tries to stop them from coming up from Egypt. And the king says, look, I don't have a bone to pick with you, but that's when Josiah gets killed. But nevertheless, the Pharaoh on the monuments in Egypt carves that he was victorious in this battle, and And everybody thought, Egypt must have won. Well, then they finally discovered the Hittite records. And the Hittite record says, we had that Pharaoh surrounded, and he barely escaped by the skin of his teeth with his tail between his legs, and he ran back to Egypt. And all of a sudden they realized, you can't trust everything. They don't want to put negative things on their monument. I mean, who would do that, right? So the idea is that if there's no God, and there's no absolute truth and absolute right and wrong, what's wrong with manipulating history if it accomplishes your political end? George Orwell said, those who control the past control the future, And those who control the present control the past. So if you can control the present, you can decide what's in the history books about the past, and people draw their identity, their trajectory, their purpose from the past. And so that's where the 1619 Project comes in, and Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, this idea that you want to manipulate it to push your agenda. Carl Sandburg, a poet, said, "When a nation goes down, one condition may always be found. They forgot where they came from." And here's the Sun Tzu quote. "Supreme excellence consists in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting." And then fifth generation warfare, getting your enemy to surrender without them even being aware that there was a war. So the picking up from last night, we talked about brainwashing a nation. Well, the term brainwashing came from the Buddhist concept of cleansing the mind, right? Of thought, sort of an emotional reset. And this comes to the highlight during the Korean War. So young guys are very patriotic. They go into the war and they're captured. And when we rescue them, they hate America. It's like, what happened to them? They did something called brainwashing, where they would put somebody in isolation for a long period of time and go through sensory deprivation and trauma to the place where they craved having things get back to normal. They craved having relationships with other people. They craved it so much that then they would bring them out and they would have a room with six chairs, and sitting in those chairs were guys who had already caved. And before they could be accepted in the group, they had to confess their whiteness. They had to confess that they were part of the evil Western capitalist system, and they were fighting and they were doing all this bad. And once they confessed all that, then they were accepted into this group of other guys. And so it was a manipulation of the strong desire that people have to fit in with the group, but doing it, it's sort of like you have a dog that is very unruly and doesn't like you, and imagine locking it in a room for half a week with no light, no food, and this dog barks itself out, and it's finally just lying there half dead, and you open the door, and you give it some water, food, and pet it, and you close it, and you keep going, you give it water, food, and pretty soon it's gonna have an emotional reset, and it's going to look at you as its new benefactor, right? That's what you do to brainwash prisoners, but the idea is you also do it nationally. Now, a little side note, they found out that if someone had a sense of humor, it was really hard to brainwash them, because they'd be like, oh, this is fun, you know? But they also found that the same thing was done with captives from Indian tribes, right? So early colonial America, the Indians would capture people from villages, you know, and they would leave them outside the teepee through the cold. And then when they finally would, you know, give them some food, and then they would have them go through different things to be accepted into the tribe. And then also in Islam, they would capture the young Christian boys. They called it the Dev Sharma, or the blood tax. And they would take these Christian boys away from their Christian families after they would capture an area, and they'd have them live outside in the backyard for a year. And these poor guys were like traumatized. And then they would forget their family, forget where they came from, and then they would begin to give them little bits. And finally, they had to confess Islam before they would be accepted into the community, and then they would become really fierce soldiers. They were called Janissaries. There's also the term Stockholm Syndrome, where the captives ended up, you know, liking their captors. And so this idea is you isolate somebody, put them through isolation, maybe like having them stay in their homes, right? Maybe with masks, and so much so that the people just crave having things get back to normal. And they say, okay, but before we get back to normal, you've got to take this. You've got to have this done to your body. You've got to sign up for this. You've got to waive your rights and freedoms and everything. And people want to get back to normal so much, that is the manipulation. So human beings have a natural desire to want to be in a group. We all know that growing up. There's the clique, right, in school, and you want to be part of the clique, and the worst thing is to be kicked out of the clique and ostracized. It's gone online now. Everybody wants to be liked and followed and friended, and nobody wants to be unliked and blocked and deplatformed, right? You're emotionally attached to this. Now, at the beginning of America's history, most of the country was Christian, right, at the colonial founding time. And so there were some people who were not Christian, but they wanted to be part of the group, and so they would change their behavior and have basic Christian morality just because the natural human desire to want to go along with the group. Unfortunately, we've lost that. And the other side now has the magnetic, the gravitational pull, and we're trying to hang on, but they're pushing this group perception to move in their direction. So approval of man is, it's something that human nature craves, but it's an ever-moving goalpost. Because if you say, well, you gotta do this to be accepted, okay, you do it. And then they say, okay, we're gonna change it up now. Now you gotta do this to be accepted. Now you gotta do this. And so they move the goalposts. Again, most cultures is called honor shame culture. That's not an actual term of what's right or wrong. It's you do what brings you and your family honor, and you avoid those that bring you and your family shame. So some Sharia Islamic families, if the daughter embarrasses the family in front of their group, their ummah, their community, they'll kill their own daughter in an honor killing. So the idea of manipulating the group to get people to brainwash a nation it was studied in the 1970s. It's called the Solomon-Ash Conformity Experiment. And they would do it on college campuses. I talked to somebody that actually was been part of one. They would have 8 students that they would pull into a room. 7 had been paid ahead of time to be actors. 1 was a naive participant. And the teacher would put 2 cards on the front desk. 1 card simply had 1 line and the other 3 lines. 1 longer, 1 shorter, 1 the same. And beginning with the paid actors, one by one, they would say that the shorter line was equal to the first line. By the time it got around to the 8th naive participant, 30% of them would deny their own eyes to fit in with the group. Could you imagine that? They could see right there that this line is not the same, but they would cave. And now if only one other person disagreed, it went from 30% down to 5%. So that encourages us to stand up. But this is, again, this has been studied, and it's called the spiral of silence, that people will self-censor their views if they think they are in the minority. They even did a wine tasting test. And they had all these couples in there. Everybody was in on it except one couple. And they poured vinegar in the wine. And this couple writes on the little card, this tastes terrible, right? But then all the other ones stood up and they said good things. They said, oh, this has character. This is just robust. This is really good. And it finally gets around to this couple. They had scratched out what they had put. And they stood up and said, yeah, it was good. And then when somebody said, well, you know, all they did was pour vinegar in it, the couple who had changed their views criticized that person for saying that and was defending it. And it's a phenomenon called false enforcement. Once people buy in to the deception, they will help enforce it and make you, oh, you're not wearing your mask. And it's like, why are we wearing this anyway? I don't know, I'm not gonna think about that, but I bought into this, and so I'm gonna help enforce it. Now, it's a powerful, powerful thing to want to fit in with the group. I mean, here's Peter, who was with Jesus 3 years. And now he's with a small group around the fire outside the high priest's house. And when this unnamed woman comes up and says, you were with Jesus. He looks over and he sees the disapproval of the group and he caves and denies Jesus because of this group around this fire. I mean, if there was not a group there, I'm sure he wouldn't have denied it, right? It was just the one girl, but there was this pressure from the group. Now, after Jesus' resurrection, Peter, filled with the Holy Spirit, had courage, and he stood up to the group. He stood up to the Sanhedrin, and when they said, we gave you strict orders not to teach in his name, Peter replied, we must obey God rather than men. Amen. Amen. So if somebody's not a Christian, if they don't have the Holy Spirit, the pressure is great to cave. It's called the fear of man. And Jesus calls us out of the fear of man to only have the fear of God. Right? He says, you got to love me more than being accepted by your mother, sister, brother, or any other group. You've just got to care about what I care about, right? So you take your eyes off a man and you look to God. I love it when the early church was persecuted. They didn't pray that the persecution stop. They prayed for boldness. They said, Lord, look on their threats and grant that your servants, that with all boldness they may speak their word. And then Jeremiah in 1:8 says, be not afraid of their faces, for I am with thee to deliver thee. If you read that chapter in Jeremiah, it says, if you do get afraid of their faces, I will shame you in front of them. So you better have backbone, right? I love the athlete that wouldn't bow, Sam Coonrod, who was a Giants pitcher. And he would, July 23rd, 2020, he was the only player not to kneel. And when they asked why, he says, "I'm a Christian. So I just believe that I can't kneel before anything besides God." And Orlando Magic forward Jonathan Isaac was the lone player to stand during the national anthem. And he said, "All lives are supported through the gospel. Everyone is made in the image of God, and we all share in his glory." Jesus says to some, he says, "You receive honor one from another, and seek not the honor that cometh from God only." Right? So we are to seek the approval of God, not the approval of men. And guess what? I think God is going to let it get to the place where you are squeezed and going to have to make the decision. You know, you think of it, the romance novels and the Hallmark movies or whatever, it always is some crisis point. Like a girl has, the love triangle. She's got two guys that are wanting to court her, and it gets to one place where one guy is squeezed, like, "Oh, I got this business meeting, and I'm supposed to propose to you tonight, and I'll take a rain check." And the other guy will crawl across glass just to be with her for a minute, right? So there's this crisis point where somebody's heart is revealed. And I think God is wanting to do that with us, right? I mean, here's humanity, and he's letting it put to the place where we're being seen. You know, I was thinking of God knew Abraham's heart, but he wanted to see Abraham be willing to put his son Isaac on the altar. Imagine a guy, he's watching football on TV, and you come up to him and you say, "Hey, when was the last time you told your wife you love her?" "I can't remember, but she knows my heart." It's like, okay. "When was the last time you did anything to show your wife you love her?" "I don't know, but she knows my heart." It's like, dude, we need to have a little talk here. It's like, oh, God knows my heart. Yes, he does know your heart, and he wants to hear some words out of your mouth, and he wants to see some actions, and he's going to put you in a position where you're going to be squeezed to have to do that. Now, we remind ourselves that the church was born into a one-world anti-Christian government, the Roman Empire. So evidently, God is not afraid of one-world anti-Christian governments, right? And 11 of the 12 apostles were martyred, and they tried throwing John in a pot of oil, but he survived. And Jesus says, Acts 1:8, "You shall receive power after that the Holy Ghost has come upon you, and you shall be witnesses unto me, both in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth." And that word witnesses in Greek is martyr. So in other words, you're giving your life for what you believe. And we just have to acknowledge it, that you, the moment you gave your life to Jesus, you died, and it's no longer you that live, but Christ that liveth in you, and your life belongs to him. And so Nero is the one who first started persecuting the Christians, outside of that, the Sanhedrin and everything. And he had his infamous Nero's torches. I don't know if you can see in the picture there, but he's in the big palace-y throne thing in the middle, and over to the side are Christians wrapped in burlap and tar, and they set him on fire. And there is 10 major persecutions of Christians in the first 3 centuries. And the government made it a criminal act for Christians to assemble. Does that sound familiar? And if the government caught Christians meeting together, they were subject to being arrested and killed. So Christians met in catacombs. These are caves they carved into the rock. I went to school in Rome for 6 months in college, and we toured the catacombs. You know, you'd crawl through these little tight spaces, and you'd see first century graffiti on the walls and the little niches where they would stick the bodies of those that had died, and then they would have the bones later they'd collect and they'd wrap up and so forth. But this was the Christian experience for 3 centuries. And Christianity exploded in growth. It was intensely personal. It was you and your Christian friends, and they barely had the Bible. I mean, they had maybe a letter from Paul floating around. But their hearts were touched by Jesus, and they were willing to die for Jesus. And so they had these persecutions, and the worst was Diocletian. So he had lost some battles with Persia, and he asked his generals why, and his generals said, well, you've allowed the army to neglect worshiping the Roman gods. So Diocletian says, okay, army, everyone has to worship the Roman gods. Well, this is the third century, and so there's a lot of Christians by this time in the military, and they cannot worship the Roman gods, so they are purged out of the military. Once the Christians are out of the military, Diocletian decides to use the military to force the entire Roman Empire to return to worshiping the Roman gods. And he carried on the worst persecution of Christians, arresting pastors, imprisoning and killing the believers.